This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Green Tea CR Phytosome Formula from Purity Products. It's the power of three of nature's top superfoods, a clinically tested green tea plus curcumin and resveratrol, all in one simple capsule. It's clinically proven to support your energy, vitality, and cardiovascular function. The secret behind Green Tea CR is its phytosome matrix, which boosts its green tea power by over 200% compared to regular green tea. Our friends at Purity Products have a free bottle for you to put to the test. Just pay $4.95 for shipping. Experience the power of this trio and see how good you can feel. Call 1-800-218-6030. That's 1-800-218-6030. Call now. As these move fast, dial 1-800-218-6030. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, here we are. It's January, and we're coping with bleak and cold weather, but we're going to provide a guiding light in your quest to retake your health. It's been proposed that we follow a dry January. Layla Mudin is our nutritional expert here.
Okay, dry January.
Have you heard about the dry January?
Yeah. I think this is popular in Great Britain.
Right.
To no alcohol at all in January.
Which is good because drinking to excess is a national sport in Great Britain.
I don't think just Great Britain, Dr. Ross.
No, but really, especially for some reason, like binge drinking is a big problem. I mean, the streets of Liverpool and Manchester on a Sunday morning are littered with the detritus of a heavy night's partying.
Yeah.
And so they're calling for a dry January. And they say that there are a lot of health benefits, and they did a study.
Yeah.
The University of Sussex did a study, and they found that people lost weight, they slept better, the majority of them felt better, they saved a lot of money.
No more fatigue, they lose the bloat.
Yeah, you know, a lot of good things
energy
happen.
Energy is good.
Yeah.
Oh, I have energy. Yeah.
Apropos of another, you know, we'll get to questions in a moment. Our questions can be directed to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we've got quite a few in the mailbag. But before we do that, I'm going to run this one by you. Headline, New York City Health Department launches campaign comparing sugary drinks to cigarettes.
Oh.
Have you heard about this?
No.
That's
no. Comparing sugary drinks to cigarettes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both bad.
They're both bad. But okay, so here's a pitch. New York City health officials, which, by the way, New York is always ahead of the curve in terms of either, it depends on where you are, on the spectrum of personal liberty, is that, you know, under the auspices of Mayor Bloomberg, it was one of the first cities to ban smoking in bars.
Yeah.
And then this became a worldwide phenomenon. Nowhere in the world practically can you go into a bar and there's going to be smoke or a public place.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, it is really, I mean, very few places, even Ireland, which is a place where there's a lot of drinking and a pub culture, no more smoking in bars. So, also there was the effort to restrain the intake of soda beverages by limiting the size of the soda. And that was caused a great outcry among libertarians and people of a certain persuasion who are against the nanny state,
yes,
who felt that Bloomberg was trying to micromanage people's lives.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you could say it was a well-intentioned campaign because
you don't need that 48-ounce big gulp.
Yeah, and there's pretty much, based on the precedent of cigarettes, we know conclusively that cigarettes cause disease and kill you.
Yeah.
And they also they create a social burden because, you know, taking care of all those sick people, it could be argued, puts a big burden on the medical system.
Mm-hmm.
Although some studies suggest that if you kill people off earlier, you'll save money. According to some very grim actuarial calculations that, you know, all these efforts to keep people well, they're going to get sick and die anyway. And there'll be a point where they're going to cost the medical system. But anyway, New York City health officials are launching a new media campaign comparing sugary drinks to cigarettes. They will remind New Yorkers that sugary drinks can lead to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cavities, and weight gain, blah, blah, blah.
one in four adults and one in three public high school students drink at least one sugary drink daily. Rates are higher in communities of color, especially among young Black and Latino children. There's a very interesting article recently that I read that traces a flip in obesity statistics. You know, it used to be that poor people were thin and rich people were fat.
Yes.
So if you go to, you know, where I just was
200 years ago
in Belgium,
yeah,
you know, you would see these paintings of the Flemish masters of like really pleasantly plump women and men.
Mm-hmm.
And they could afford to eat.
Yeah.
So that was like,
and it was
affluence.
A status symbol.
It was a status symbol.
To be
look at my plump,
portly.
My plump wife. I'm able to feed her. She's not skin and bones.
Mm-hmm.
She's very fleshy and buxom and blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
She's got,
uh-huh.
So anyway. The demographic trend switched officially in the 1970s.
Yes.
And they correlate that with the introduction of high fructose corn syrup. That was the factor. And of course, most of the high fructose corn syrup that we consume to excess comes from sugary drinks.
Yeah. Soft drinks, all of that.
So they were invented literally and popularized in the 70s. So There's a big ad campaign. Sugary drinks will be compared to the effects of cigarettes.
Yeah.
So that's going to be an interesting campaign. I mean, will it show they now show people with like mouth cancer and like horrible clogged blood vessels, like really disgusting commercials for to get people to dissuade people from smoking. Will they show like people's livers, fatty liver, and like visceral fat, and people getting, tummy tucks or something.
Yeah.
Based on the soft drinks. I don't know.
Yeah.
These high impact, ghastly looking ads.
Exactly. And I think, I don't believe in scare tactics.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose you could go on the Dr. Oz show, and as he's done many times, is show you a clear, clean, healthy lung compared to a 40-year smoker's lung. And, oh, my goodness. Yeah, I don't want that. That could be, help.
Also,
but
keep in mind, that this, where's the money come from? The money for some of the cigarette stuff comes from successful lawsuits against the cigarette companies.
Yeah.
The money for this is going to come out of the public coffers.
Mm.
Is this money well spent? I mean, you're a taxpayer in New York City. You live in New York. Some of your paycheck gets peeled off to the city government, which has decided that it's going to conduct a jihad against soft drinks.
Yeah.
Some people may object to that.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. As much as I know the ill effects of sugar and so forth, I believe in personal liberty, too. If you want that 48-ounce Big Gulp, I'm going to absolutely urge you not to have it.
Mm-hmm.
But I will defend your right to have what you want. It's kind of like a free speech thing. I may hate what you say,
mm-hmm.
but I will defend with my life your right to say it.
To have the big gulp.
Yeah, to have the big gulp. Don't do that. Don't do that. Just like, don't be mean.
So,
something.
This could generate some headlines. Is prominent nutritionist will defend your right to have a big gulp.
But we'll encourage you never to do that.
Okay. All right, so you're on record now.
I'm on record now. I'm saying, don't do it.
Okay.
You can do whatever you want. That's what I mean by personal liberty.
Right. Now, but then here's the thing.
You know, be responsible. You know,
this is called a moral license.
Hmm.
The consequences of it will be borne by the public at large.
Yeah.
You know, because if someone smokes or someone, indulges in a six-pack of Coke every day, they might develop type 2 diabetes. They might be subject to eye problems, amputations.
Cardiovascular disease. Cancer.
And, the age of 42 or 48. And, we pay for public hospitals here in New York. You know,
that's
taxpayers
true.
Underwrite that.
That's true. And so, apparently, according to de Blasio, who just announced it a little while ago, that they're going to cover all people in New York who cannot afford insurance.
Okay.
All people. To get them out of the ERs and have access to primary care.
Okay.
Which is interesting, but
It is a little bit of a matter of re-education, though, because some studies have shown that in spite of the fact that people are covered for primary care and prevention, they still, out of force of habit, they wait until they get really sick and then they bounce into your emergency room.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the availability of care, It's making it connect to the patients and the prospective patients. And many people, either they don't have the organization, the wherewithal, or the knowledge to, or motivation to undertake primary care visits. Like, hello, I'm here, and, you know, check my blood pressure, check my cholesterol. How am I doing, doc? They're not geared towards that mentality.
Yeah.
Even if it were available. Mm-hmm. So it's we're going to have to, I think, educate. And, I'm not sure that showing rotting teeth or diseased blood vessels or, you know, pounds and pounds of blubber is going to dissuade some people from going for hedonistic pleasures.
That's true. It sways some people the other way. Oh, you're going to try to scare me with that tactic? Well, I'm going to dig my heels in and hold my breath and say, no.
Yeah, a certain percentage of people will.
It's like resentment. They know
there's nobody in America anymore who knows that smoking is not really bad for you.
Yeah.
So that's a testament to human irrationality.
Okay.
And the power of addiction. Mm-hmm. And sugar is just as addictive.
So it's addictive substance on the planet. Yeah. And that's why they need to have their soda fix.
So what will happen is we'll peel off some people who are, you know, going to be paying attention. You know, like maybe instead of half the people indulging in smoking, now a quarter of the people indulge in smoking. And maybe we'll peel off some people who won't drink the sodas. But some people will just say, I don't know. I realize it's bad for me. I can't stop. It's too delicious. I crave it. And oh, by the way, how are you going to compare with, you know, I just watched the football game last night and it's like all these ads for like soft drinks and beer and, you know, it's like, how can you compete with that?
That's true.
I mean, the way.
More car commercials.
What's that?
More pharmaceutical ads, more car commercials. How do you compete with that? I know. Which is the more evil? I know. It's terrible.
Anyway, let's get to questions.
Yeah. And I was going to say another thing about Dry January. Consider keeping it going all the way to St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
That's 2.5 months of dry.
I'm on a roll. We're almost halfway through the month and I haven't had any. It's not a big thing. I was in Belgium and there was this great beer all over the place.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a few, but I didn't really feel any compunction to, you know,
to
drink a lot
more
of it. Plus, I know that it, you know, it kind of messes with my sleep cycles and it.
It does. And another reason
it causes me nasal congestion because there's a lot of yeast in the beer.
Yes. And the other component of alcohol is it's a proxy to sugar. So those with sugar craving, if they stop having sugar, there's something interesting I want to bring up, may have more craving for alcohol, because any recovering alcoholic who has stopped, they're putting sugar in their coffee.
You go to an AA meeting, it's like
they're having
donuts.
All of that. They revert to the original addiction.
Yeah.
In fact, there have been a few case studies in those who have had gastric bypass operations to lose weight. The very morbidly obese, they have a gastric bypass or Roux-en-Y. And of course, you're not able to consume more than maybe 500 to 800 calories a day at that point.
Right.
Something switches over in them and they become binge drinkers.
Okay.
Because this is all fluid, it was very interesting. There's only a handful of case studies.
Right.
But that craving then turns to something that they're able to take in without their stomach exploding.
It's a brain thing.
Yeah. So.
It's gratification.
It's gratification
by one means or another.
Right.
But, you know, alcohol also, in addition to its caloric value, it disinhibits you and it makes you want to eat more. That's why restaurateurs want to ply you with a drink because they know that it'll relax you.
It'll also cause a little hypoglycemia, so you become hungrier than you were when you first walked into the restaurant. And of course, the longer you're waiting for your table at the bar, the hungrier you are at that point. The alcohol just makes that worse. And then I've had patients report to me that if they have wine at dinner, the cocktail before, all of that, they find that later they want that dessert, whereas that normally they're not looking for a dessert.
Yeah.
It's almost like you want more of the same.
Yeah.
That's really what's happening. It's interesting.
Let's hear it for sobriety in 2019.
Yeah. Here we go, to temperance. Okay. So we have an email from Steve. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, can you explain why some people can go to sleep on an empty stomach, like Layla, and why some people have to have something to eat before sleep, right, or they won't sleep.
Right. Well, you can rep the, go to sleep on an empty stomach crowd, because I'm the opposite.
Okay.
I like to go to bed hungry. It's like go to bed without your meal. You know, it's like
okay.
A little bit psychological. You know,
okay.
It's like,
I've never had that growing up, go to bed without your meal.
Well, I never did either. But,
okay, you know. All right. So it wasn't some previous trauma that's that keeps me not eating before bed.
Right.
Now, traditional Chinese medicine would like all of us not to eat anything within 5 hours of bedtime.
Okay.
I would love to have dinner at 4 p.m. every day, because I'm in bed by about 10.
Yeah.
I could.
Yeah.
If I were to get hungry later, and most of the time I don't, even if it will go away.
It's just sort of a false hunger. Yeah.
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 If it occurs at all.
Much hunger is, if you don't gratify it, it sort of goes away.
Yeah. When it comes to something like intermittent fasting, I'm hungry in the morning. Most mornings I'm generally hungry, I'm ready to eat.
Well, that's because you are breaking a long fast.
Yeah, so my IF is done from the night before.
Right.
Where I'll have a late lunch or very early dinner,
right.
And then I'm not having breakfast till 7 a.m. or something.
And so I'll tell you, my own pattern is, when I'm at my leisure, I revert to this pattern. I will eat dinner, and then if I stay up a little late, like I was watching the title football game last night, and I stayed up a little later to watch Clemson beat Alabama until it was like clear that Alabama wasn't going to come back. So I was up a little later, and I had a little snack. I had some fruit with some coconut milk, which is a way to sort of get a little fat with the coconut, with the sweet of the fruit. And maybe I threw some flaxseed on it and some coconut, shredded coconut on it. And it was very substantial.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to bed. Like, within an hour. So I actually went to bed on a little bit of not a super full stomach. Because if you go to bed on a really full stomach,
that's not good.
You're digesting
all night. You're not repairing. You're not.
So one theory is that there is a relaxation response that occurs.
Yes.
When you eat. There really is. That's why people.
Serotonin.
That's why people in the afternoon,
relax.
You know, in their office, they're like, you know, it's like after a meal, you get, you know, that kind of.
Wanting to siesta.
Right, like the lions that, you know, eat a wildebeest, and then they climb up in a tree and they sleep for like, you know, 2 days.
Yeah.
Because it's the work of digestion and et cetera. And there's also a parasympathetic response to eating.
Hmm.
So it is relaxing just to eat. But there's also tryptophan that gets delivered via food.
And that helps with sleep.
And it's thought that carbohydrates drive the tryptophan a little bit more across the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
So that's, two schools of thought. And this person is right in saying different strokes for different folks. You have to find out what works for you. Now,
right.
In the morning, my ideal situation is I'll get up, and because I ate fairly late, I could go exercise. I'll have, like, you know, some tea or some black coffee.
Mm-hmm.
No food.
Some get up and go.
Get up and go, do exercise, and then
a little warmth.
I'm pretty
warm
hungry,
up.
And then I'll eat at 11.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, there you go.
And that's good. My intermittent fasting, but it occurs, you back end it, I front end it.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
am going, you know, considerable number of hours without eating, at least, you know, at least 12, maybe 14.
Yeah. And you know what else is interesting? On the days that I do IF, you know, my late lunch, and then the following morning, I'm really not hungry at all. I mean, I almost feel like I could just keep it going, but I don't, because it's not the
You're
right thing to do
either. You're becoming a breatharian.
Right. A what?
A breatharian.
A breatharian. Now, Steve, I have to ask.
Wait. You don't have an eating disorder.
No.
You're one of the few.
Not few. I've had a few classmates that never took off their coats in the winter.
What I'm saying is, medical nutritionists, ADA and, what's the credential?
RDs. Yeah.
They're very high because of the interest in food. There's almost sometimes an obsessive concern with food.
That's true.
That generates anorexia or bulimia.
Well, it's kind of like physician, heal thyself. You become that which you can. So will the dietitian.
Like the crazy psychiatrists or, you know, whatever.
Isn't that something? Is you gravitate to the thing that you want to fix.
Right.
Now, why some people can go to sleep on an empty stomach, and why some people have to eat something before they sleep or they won't sleep. I imagine that has more to do with craving, with looking for serotonin, with looking for that kind of thing to help them.
Maybe there's a genetic component to it.
Maybe there is a genetic component. And it depends on what they're noshing on before they go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it a scoop of ice cream?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a hard-boiled egg?
Right.
Maybe you've got some hypoglycemia and it keeps you from waking up in the middle of the night.
One solution, really, to that problem is just to go to sleep.
Go to sleep.
Don't eat, because if you eat, you'll get another sort of second wind.
Well, it's the other thing. We were up watching the football game, so you had to nosh on something. The later we're up, the more the lights are on, the more hungry we are.
Right.
You know, it's carbohydrate craving. That's what happens.
Right.
Everybody should be going to bed by 10, 10:30. European natural medicine says our most restorative sleep occurs between 11 p.m. 2 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm telling everybody, be in bed by 10:30.
This is going to become a less and less popular podcast because we're saying,
oh, no.
Don't drink, go to bed at 10 o'clock, don't have a snack after dinner. This is like...
But I reserve your right to have that big gulp. Oh, no, this is all wrong.
yeah, it's like the... Yeah. Welcome to the Austerity Podcast.
Yeah.
I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're going to tell you everything you can't do and how boringly you have to conduct your life.
Right, because it's New Year's Resolution Month, so everybody's into it.
Everybody knows nothing exciting happens until after 10 o'clock.
Yeah,
and you would not do well in Madrid.
Yeah, because I know. They're eating dinner at 10 o'clock.
That's when it starts, and then there's after-dinner entertainment.
Right.
I really did not... mesh well with the schedule there, because I visited a family member there, and they said, "Well, let's meet for dinner." So, we'll have an early dinner at 9. You know, it's like, really? I'm winding down.
That's a night out for me.
And then it was like, and then we'll go see flamenco. And the show starts at midnight. It's like, are you kidding?
Wow! Oh yeah, that's the morning I like more than anything. So,
of course, they have siestas.
Yeah. What I would say to Steve is try going to bed on a normal schedule every day, and you may find that you don't crave something before you go to bed. Mm-hmm. It could be that you're up too late.
Right.
Maybe you're working late. Maybe that's the only time you have to check your work emails and do things. Then we're stressing a little bit. We need a little nibble. We're looking to decompress.
Right.
So without getting brain foggy about it and stuff like that. So
yeah, in general, the earlier you take your food in the day, the more you're going to lose weight.
Yeah.
It's just something about that.
Yeah.
Also, there's you tend to take your food earlier in the day with more sobriety and restraint, and later on, that's when the witching hour occurs and you start to go off on, you know, more sugary foods.
And there are some people with adrenal stress that kind of need to eat not just their three square meals, but a few snacks in between just to keep them even.
Keep their blood sugar
going. So that could be something. And for those really with that adrenal stress, hypoglycemia, they do very well with a snack an hour and a half, 2 hours before bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's perfectly fine. No sugar snack. No, not like that, but
maybe
some protein,
healthy
fat.
Carb, you know.
So right. Dig into some avocado with a little lime juice and salt or something. Or that leftover chicken drumstick you didn't have at dinner that you didn't finish. So go to bed earlier. I think that's the answer. You know, I know that, you know, if my husband and I are up late on occasion or something, then we're looking for something to nosh on at 9 o'clock. I don't like doing that.
Yeah.
I just want to go to bed.
A case in point is I noticed, you know, on the trip to Europe that I took, I was on a plane and I was so excited. I barely slept on the plane. It's pretty uncomfortable to sleep on a plane.
Yeah.
Because we were had extra comfort seats, but they were still, you know, economy coach. And so I noticed that my hunger was over the top, because
you were excited.
Because I had not slept. One night of sleep deprivation can really increase your appetite, and plus, it's just more time to eat.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm not waking up in the middle of the night saying, "Hey, oh, that's been 6 hours since I ate." It's like, no, it's fine. You know.
Yeah.
You're asleep, but if you're on a plane, it's like, oh, here's this snack, that snack. They're going to keep you, you know, going a little bit, and hydrating too. So.
Yes, airplane rides are very dehydrating, very dehydrating. So, Steve, we hope that, as we digressed all over the place, answers the question. Try to go to bed at a normal hour and see how that changes your appetite. Having regular meal times, that's really another thing. People who don't eat on time or are having breakfast 2 hours later than they normally would, or they skip lunch, by dinner time they're ravenous, so forth and so on.
To establish a biorhythm.
Exactly. I think that's a huge help. So
Okay. Folks, we're going to pause now because we divide these podcasts
into
two parts.
Yeah.
Wow. Time flies when you're having fun.
Wow.
So what we'll do is we'll return and give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
I have had chronic daily migraine for many years and am completely disabled by migraines at this point.
Ooh.
Wow.
Okay. Well, let's tackle the issue of migraine triggers. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin, her nutritionist, and we'll be right back with more of Q&A with Layla.